We are back here on News Radio KMAN as we bring you the League of Women Voters of Manhattan Riley County candidate forum. Up next will be the USD 3-3 candidates, and they're going over the rules right now, so I'll turn it over to Sarah Fisher, the moderator.
Them draw their place out of a bag with all the numbers, so that's how they got in this particular lineup, for better or for worse. I also want to note that there are 10. We actually have 10 people on the ballot. We only have, I believe, 8 here, right? 1, 2, 3. I went to college. We only have 8 up here. One is actually a library employee, and she cannot participate because she's she just stepped out, a library employee, Andrea Schwartz. And the other, and one other one is going to be on your ballot, but I guess according to the newspaper, they have officially dropped out. So, is it 3:30? Can I get started? All right. If it's all right with you guys, I'd like to go ahead and get started. Officially get started, sorry. I get really antsy. Do you guys get antsy when you have parties? I get really antsy. I just want to get it started. Okay. My name is Sarah Fisher, and I'm going to serve as the moderator. I'm also on the leadership team with the League of Women Voters. My other lady league leadership team out there somewhere. Yeah, some of you have no doubt been on our leadership team before, or we will recruit you to be on our leadership team going forward. I'm sure you've all been to these forums before. This one is jointly organized and sponsored by the American and the Chamber of Commerce. I'm going to turn it over right now to Mike Mattson with the Chamber of Commerce, and he'll talk about that.
We're clapping for Sarah because she did a great job at moderating American Association of University Women and the Manhattan chapter of the League of Women Voters. There we go. Sorry, I used to be a broadcaster. I should know these things. American Association of University Women, Manhattan chapter of the League of Women Voters, Manhattan Area Chamber of Commerce. I represent the chamber on behalf of our 600 members. Thank you for coming today. This is a wonderful turnout. We would not have expected this many folks. And one more expression of gratitude to the candidates who have decided that it is in their best interest to serve and to run for public office and to put their name on the ballot. So thank you all, and let's have a great forum.
We also need to acknowledge K-Man in the back. This is being broadcast. This is being broadcast over the air. And because it's being broadcast and you can't see over the air, I also am going to ask my candidates that when you answer your questions or introduce, please introduce yourself for their listening audience as well. Just a little bit of housekeeping here. Talk about the structure of the forum. Again, I know many of you have already been to one of these. The first round candidates will be invited to make opening remarks for a minute and a half. We have our timekeepers right here, and we also have some folks running around picking up cards. Hopefully when you came in, you got a card. We have Linda Utoff on our executive committee, but we also have a student from the Manhattan High Civic Engagement Club. Yes. Now, doesn't that seem fitting for a school board forum? So if you have comments, we have some curated questions up here at the front ready to go, but we're also interested in what the audience wants, so you wave your card, those will come up, and between me and my colleague, we will curate those questions as well. So you'll have minute introductions, then you'll have... Yes, we'll just start there. Yes, it's been a long day. All right, friends, we'll go ahead and get started. We're going to start over here with candidate number one. And then, and I'll tell you more in a minute.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks to the League, AAUW, and the Chamber for sponsoring today's event. I am Kristen Brighton. I am a Manhattan native, a parent of 2, 1 Manhattan High School graduate, 1 Manhattan High School senior. That blows my mind. I am a small business owner. I have been involved in the Chamber of Commerce and served as chair of the board in 2016. And it was through that experience I really got the taste of getting to be involved in my community and help being part of the process. So after I rolled off chamber leadership in 2019, I ran for this seat for the first time. And so I'm finishing my first term on the USD 383 Manhattan Ogden School Board. I've enjoyed all 4 years, despite the fact that 6 weeks after I took my seat, COVID started. So it was a very challenging period to be a newly elected person. I fully believe that anyone who runs and gets their first elected office spends most of their first term learning what they're doing. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot of things to learn. What are the rules? What are the laws? And what are things that we've done this way for a long time and we're only doing them because that's the way we've always done them? So I try to be a person with big ideas and a lot of vision. And as somebody who really wants to move Manhattan forward, I have many things I would like to see us continue to do to grow our district to make it an even greater place to live, work, and learn.
Thank you. My name is Greg Hoyt. I'm a lifelong community member of Manhattan. Served in the school district as an educator for 31 years, 16 years teaching math at Manhattan High School, 9 years as principal at Eisenhower Middle School, 6 years as principal at Manhattan High School. Retired in July of 2018, right before COVID hit, which makes me one of the smartest individuals on the face of the planet. My interest in serving on the board, and I want to thank everyone that's running for office. I think we all have a duty to participate, so I thank you for your attendance today. All elected positions, I think, are important positions to fill, and you need to fill with individuals that can be open-minded, but forward-thinking as well. And I love this community. I love this school district. I think my experience brings something to the table that would be valuable to the board. I would appreciate your vote. And if I don't get your vote, I'm going to get behind this Board of Education, whomever is elected. And so thank you again for your attendance today.
Hi, I'm Katie Allen, and I'd also like to thank everybody for coming out today. It's really great to be able to talk about some school board issues and answer questions where there's a great audience to hear and hopefully share with their friends about what's going on. I am a parent of two kids also in the schools right now, both at Anthony Middle School, and we've been in the district since kindergarten. I'm married to Bill Allen. He's a veteran who came to us from Fort Riley. A little bit of my background. I started my career working in nonprofit agencies. for example, I worked for United Way and a community coalition, and all of our work was really centered around creating opportunities for kids. So whether that's opportunities to learn or helping improve conditions where they can succeed in life. So I've done a lot of work really specifically related to education. For example, in that early career, I spent about 8 years working in early child development. Right now, I provide technical assistance to a variety of state and local education agencies working on everything from literacy to leadership development. And I'm really interested in serving on the board to make sure that all kids in our community have access to a high-quality public education. And I sincerely appreciate your vote in November.
Good afternoon, and everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I am nervous, and I'm also happy to be here. Thank you all as well, and I am running because I believe in common sense, focused priorities, and core values. I'm telling you that first because I think a lot of you are wondering what I'm doing up here. So to begin, I really do care about the kids, and I am fifth-generation Kansan, both sides, by way of Texas and Colorado and Chicago. Education was incredibly important to me because my family was an alternative family. I went to a lot of different schools, had the IEP. I was at risk, and my teachers were my friends. I now enjoy being a certified massage therapist, and I'm so nervous, guys. Please forgive me. Oh, my goodness. My name is Andrea Engelken-Cervenka. I left my name at the door along with my courage. No, I'm just kidding. And I've been in Manhattan for 22 years, and as a homeowner across the street from Marlatt Elementary, I love seeing these kids. And as a property owner, we have a high stake. Half of our property taxes go to public education, which we all value. We all want our teachers to be well-supported. We want everyone to feel included and like a person. And thank you for your time. Ms. Courtney.
Good afternoon. I love the turnout. I'm so glad that you all joined us today. Yes, my name is Courtney Jean Hockman. I'm running for school board because I've lived in Manhattan for 23 years, and I have three children in the district. Well, technically, I have two children in the district. My third will be joining. I came to Manhattan from California to go to K-State. I graduated K-State with my bachelor's and my master's in educational counseling and student development. So I do have an education background, but mostly focused on higher ed. So I see what happens next. In the past 11 years that I've been involved with the district, I have had phenomenal experiences and built relationships with teachers, staff, everyone involved. My oldest son is a special education student, so I have a very unique and distinct perspective of how our district functions. And I have the privilege to have the time to be able to do this, where a lot of special education parents do not. My middle child, my son, is 8 and in the third grade, and so I refer to him as a COVID kindergartner. So I parented two children through COVID, and I'm of the mind that if you didn't parent children through COVID, you don't really have a complete picture of what has gone on prior to that, during, and since then. The bottom line is, I just want what's best for our students and everyone to have a quality education.
Hello, my name is Kurt Herman. I'm a 62-year-old father of two boys who attended Manhattan High School kindergarten through 12th grade, graduated from Fort Hays State University as a double major in computer science and business administration, been an IT professional for over 35 years, and I'm currently an IT director at a local bank. I was raised in a household with two teachers. My mother was an elementary ed teacher. My dad was my high school principal. Perfect attendance all through high school, by the way. Originally got involved with the district in 1999 when we first moved here to Manhattan. Got involved with the PTO, and I think everybody that's a board member has probably sat on a PTO or been on a site council at some point. I've been appointed by Dr. Randy Watson, who's the state director of education to the virtual ed advisory committee, and also served on the. I'm also one of the founders of the Kansas Educational Leadership Institute through Kansas State University, which is a mentoring program for superintendents, which is part of licensure now. That's required by state. And I've proudly served on this board for 16 years now. I'm running for reelection. I've got another term in me, and I still got the fire in me to serve this community. And I've seen a lot of diversity in this adversity and diversity in this district, and some good, some bad, but I've got a lot of institutional experience and knowledge that I bring to the table, and I hope you approve and give me another term.
Hello, my name is Frank Beer. I moved here in 2001, so I've been here 22 plus years. I'm getting to the point where I think I almost qualify as a local. Which is something my family and I, when we moved here, we've had four kids who all graduated from Manhattan High. We're very proud of what they did. I'm very happy to say that this school district set them up for success. And that's a primary reason that I'm running, is that I want all kids to have opportunity to succeed. And I believe our school district gives that. The trick is finding ways for those kids to be motivated to access that. As a school board member, it's our job to make sure that that opportunity exists. I also would like to bring my business acumen. I've spent my entire life. I started packing groceries for my dad's grocery store when I was 6 years old, and I have carried on through business that entire time. I believe that that acumen can be beneficial on the school board, and I look forward to answering questions today. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Rob Busby. I want to say thanks to the League of Women Voters and to the Manhattan Chamber and to everyone who made it out here and everyone who's listening. I really appreciate that. I want to say thanks also to my fellow candidates and hopefully prospective colleagues. It's great to be able to do this, to have this opportunity. I graduated from Manhattan High in 1991. I'm currently running an IT and cybersecurity department in a local federal agency, and that's kind of what I do. I also teach part-time cybersecurity as an adjunct at a major university here in Kansas. I won't say its name because they don't do purple. And so that's kind of who I am now. The statistics said I wasn't going to make it to this point. I wasn't going to graduate college. I was not going to get a STEM degree in cybersecurity as a master's degree or anything like that. Because I was the poor kid. You know, my mom was 14 when she got pregnant, didn't make it out of the eighth grade before she had to stop going to school and raise me and my sisters. And that kind of changes things. So I understand what our kids are going through in our schools. And I want to make sure that our teachers, who meant so much to me, my fourth grade and sixth grade teachers changed my life. I want to make sure that we give all those teachers, my high school computer science teacher, all those tools that they need. And I want to make sure we do it in a responsible way so that we take care of the next generation. Thanks.
All right. Thank you all for introducing yourself. Before I get to the questions, I'd just like to remind everybody about what the League's mission here is. We are a nonpartisan organization. We do not support or endorse or oppose candidates. Our goal is education and advocacy on issues. And I hope that's why you've come tonight. I hope you've come tonight to learn about the issues. I would also like to invite the candidates to ask them to please stick to the issues and not to engage in personal attacks. But I also think it's important we realize that some of the folks up here have voting records. For better or for worse, they have voting records. Along the same lines, I'd also invite you all to refrain from side conversations as well as the folks up here. So the first question, and I'll do my best to sort of prime you, as they say in education, what this question is about. This question is about taxes. And we will start here with number one and go down. And then the next question, we're going to start with number two, and we're going to go down the line that way. So here is your question. Property tax rates are on the rise for Manhattan businesses and residents. How do you think the school board should balance the needs of students without overburdening taxpayers? How do you think the school board should balance the needs of students without overburdening taxpayers? And you have a minute and a half.
That's a small question, but I'll take a stab at it. We just approved our budget at the beginning of September. We had a budget hearing. One person from the community came. So I know everybody is upset about taxes, but we had very little dialogue with the community about that. The one person who came is someone who comes to a lot of those meetings. I'm sure most of you know his name. But if you haven't, I would encourage you to go back and watch the recording of that September 6th meeting. During that budget hearing, Eric Reed spent nearly an hour explaining how schools are funded and how we get from looking at all of the needs and expenses of a school district clear through the process of determining the mill levy. Unlike the city and the county, we work the other way. We look at all of the costs, all of the expenses, all of the extremely complicated formula that the state has put together for us to figure out which kids and which systems get which types of funding. Some kids get 0.5 funding, some get 1.5 funding. They continually are changing everything. And it's a huge, masterful work of art that they start about this time of year for the next budget cycle. We spend at least 4 months at the board table talking about it. So I know, as everybody, as a homeowner myself, I understand none of us like to see our taxes go up. But the reality is, for us to keep people working in our buildings, we're going to have to come to terms with how we're going to continue to fund education. I served on teacher negotiations this year. I was very proud that we were able to give our teachers a 5.55% increase. That's the largest we've been able to give in the last 4 years. But not every year we've been able to do that. And to keep people in education, we're going to have to figure out how to balance how we pay teachers with the work they have to do.
Greg Hoyt, taxes are they're a fact of our life. And the bottom line is we've got three taxing entities locally, school districts, the county, and the city. The largest portion of budgets are in people, and our job is to serve students, and it takes people to serve those students. So when you evaluate how you're spending your money, it's difficult to cut large chunks of money without somehow negatively impacting kids. So I think whatever scheme that we use needs to be evaluated through the lens of, is this going to harm kids? Is this going to keep a neutral status with kids? Or is this going to enhance what we can do for kids? So what's one thing that we can do together as a community? This is Manhattan. And I don't think the school district needs to sit on an island by itself, and I don't think the county needs to sit on an island by itself, and I don't think the city does. I think that we can always be looking for more partnerships and somehow enhance the value added of three taxing entities to minimize the impact on our residents, but also enhance the experience of every community member, our faculty, staff, but most importantly, our students.
Katie Allen, and I have a similar response to what Mr. Hoyt shared, but one of the things that I think I am understanding more and more with mill levies and school budgets, I think we're about at the top of what we can do. So we're not going to be looking at increasing things in the near future because there's just not that opportunity. But what we really need to do is look at the programs that we have and think of those as investments in our students. And we need to be looking at what are we actually getting out of the programs that we have right now. Are students meeting the academic standards and achievement that we expect? Are there things that we should be doing that we're not? Are there things that we could stop doing? Are there actually things that we maybe just need to improve? So I think looking at the budget from that perspective of really what are we doing with it and are we being effective with the money is where we need to start at this point. The other thing, too, with budgeting and student needs, I think is important is that we look at how we're sharing those resources across the district to make sure that the students and the buildings that need more support are actually getting it in terms of student outcomes. One of the things, too, every community worries about taxation, and individuals do as well. But we can also, because school budgets are pretty standard, we can look at what other communities are doing to get a sense of are we really taxed more than we should be, and are we getting what we need from the money that we have? Thank you.
Andrea Ingokin-Cervenka, when it comes to balancing the needs of students without overburdening taxpayers, anything that doesn't directly contribute to positive student outcomes and well-beings needs to be evaluated and potentially audited. Professional development, our teachers need support. They need a wide variety of tools, whether technological, to meet different learning styles. The teachers have to have incredibly big tool belts, and they need to have resources behind them. And so it really is important. We all want our kids to be good citizens, well-educated, and so this is tough. I agree with Mr. Hoyt that there does need to be more dialogue between the different moving parts, the city, the county. I refer to it sometimes as the scarecrow tactic. The county might point at the city might point at the county, and I'm just confused as an ordinary person. And so I think that would be great to promote transparency and dialogue and really look for those opportunities. I think that we need to explore where we're leaving money on the table from federal money at the end of the years, things like that. We need to make sure we're clawing back any money the government has promised us. And I would like to encourage more fundraising for the various activities and have more community involvement with the students directly to get them starting to really be able to get behind their things and get support.
Courtney Jane Hockman. So there's lots of moving pieces, and many, many people have said that the school district budget is complex, and it is, but it's not impossible to understand. I spent over an hour with our outgoing budget specialist and our incoming budget specialist, and I have so much respect for them, and even I have a little more understanding than I did in the beginning. Part of these moving pieces is that the school board has to project how many students we're going to have and of what kinds, because as Kristen was saying, certain students are weighted differently. So our at-risk students, our special needs students, our military students are handled differently in the amount of funding that needs to be allotted to them. The second piece of that is the government has specific things that we must do with specific pots of money, and so that leads to having less flexibility about where we can move things to. I would say that one of the things that we can do to not overburden our taxpayers is to be politically active at the state level and get the state to contribute where they are supposed to. One example of this is to fully fund special education, which is a high-dollar bucket. So that we can take that burden off. The other thing is, with our budget, we're never quite sure what we're going to get back from the state and federal levels, so we have to hope for the best. The thing about staying with what they call the revenue neutral rate is that we can't have, you know, the 2022 money is not the same as 2023.
So every year when we begin the budgeting process, we ask our staff to come up with like 1%, 2%, different cuts that they could live with in their schools if that becomes necessary. And our, you know, the school budget is very complicated, but we only have three funding sources: the federal level, as state, what we get from the state, and then our property taxes. And you know, and we don't get a blank check. We can't just spend the money where we want. It's earmarked. We have to send so much for special education, for transportation, and so that's part of the challenge of the funding. And I think part of the key to it is you know, the legislature. And not just our, because our local legislators are there and they're really fighting for us. But I mean, we're talking about statewide legislature involvement, and the KSB does that for the Manhattan School District. You know, and also, you know, fully funding special education. I mean, there's lots of things that could help us out. Not necessarily fully funding, but give us the opportunity to move the money from one bucket to the other. Because right now we're kind of restricted on the money that we can move around, especially for a special education. So hopefully if the legislature keeps, we're supposed to get an increase of funding every year. Right now we get roughly $4,400 per student. And then there's weightings, like Chris had mentioned. There's, for some SPED students, we get 1.5 weighting, and so for other students. So, but I think the answer is the legislature, and then making sure we can provide services for our students.
Frank Beer. This is an area that I've been talking about. To be clear, there's been, for clarity, your tax bill, when you get it, amazingly, a couple weeks after the election, you're going to see about approximately a 14% increase in spending from the school district. The school district is going to receive approximately $1 million more this year from the state than they got. There was no discussion of cuts. That's my issue. There was very little discussion. There were presentations about the numbers, but there was never a discussion in this year's budget about the possibility of reducing that mill levy. It was on the screen. One question was asked one time. The answer was the administration does not advise that, and that was the end of the discussion. The first time that someone asked when is the extra money going to be spent, or what's this going to be spent on, approximately $4 million, by the way, from you, the taxpayer, in property taxes. The first time that was asked was when, after the final motion was made to approve it. They then listed out, it's badly done in the paper, it was listed out as the employees get about half of it, the rest go to these seven programs. They then did the second, and they voted, and that was it. My solution, more discussion.
Rob Busby. So the mill levy went down just a small fraction, and as we know, the valuations went up quite a bit, and that's just a function of inflation. And when we talk about inflation, our teachers' pay, the board was able to give them, I think, a 5.5% bump, which is actually, when you can factor inflation, they're still losing ground, and they got half that last year, so they've been losing ground for a bit. On a $200,000 house, the increase that the mill levy went up raised that house's property tax bill for the school district about $14.36 a month. It's an increase, and those who are at the bottom of the scale are going to feel it the most, I feel, when it comes to rents and all of that sort of stuff. I don't mean to make light of that. We're blessed because we do have a lower mill levy than a lot of other districts, especially those around us, save for like Junction City, which receives a a very different amount of federal impact aid. They get a truckload of money because of, you know, Fort Riley and all of that sort of stuff. We have solid schools, and our solid schools will attract more growth and development. And we're continuing to do that. We're continuing to see more growth and development in this community, and that's a good thing. Because that's going to give us, we're fortunate to already have a good commercial industrial base that is growing. And when we do that, when we can have that growing base, we're going to be able to broadly ask our administration, first, I want to see 1, 2, 5, and 10% cuts. What does that look like for you? What are your priorities? What are your values? Ultimately, I do believe that we can continue doing what we're doing.
And we can actually say we're going to plan for the next 5 years to reduce mill levies by a mill a year and return $13 million to our taxpayers and still do great education.
All right. Thank you, candidates. Thank you also for introducing yourself. That's very helpful to all of us. So this next question, and you'll recall it's come that we're collecting them from the audience, too. This is a pretty broad question, guys. We're going to start with Mr. Hoyt there. It's about inclusion, and the audience asks. The audience has asked many questions about inclusivity and scholastic and performance. What is your position on meeting the needs of all students, including, and we realize your time is limited, so you may want to speak directly to one of these groups, special education, gifted, LGBTQ+, and mental health challenges? And please, can you offer a specific strategy for inclusivity?
Greg Hoyt, and another terrific, terrific question. So my experience of 31 years in the education system has told me that students are going to learn best when they feel included, when they feel safe, when they feel like they have a home, when they feel like they have adults that they can trust that are going to look out for them. Not just for some students, students that are the right gender, students that are the right color, students that have the right amount of money, students that live in the right part of town. It's all students. And so I'm a huge proponent of diversity and inclusivity. What is the best strategy to address those issues? I would say it's hiring the right people. And so as a person who made hiring decisions, I want talented educators in the classroom that know their content and can deliver that in a terrific way. But if I had a choice between somebody who was a good educator but didn't have people skills or didn't care about people versus somebody who had far more greater human skills and maybe not the technical teaching skill, I took the human skills because I could always work on the other end of it. But I had to hire the people that actually had empathy for other people first. And I think that's probably the best strategy that we can do to address inclusivity in our schools.
Katie Allen, and one of the things for any of these groups that we have to remember is this is public education, and there's an expectation that we get all of our kids to meet certain standards. So having conversations with folks sometimes is a reminder, like, we can't discriminate regardless of our own feelings of what we like and we don't like about certain characteristics. But the strategy I'd like to talk about is mental health for students, and I don't think we're doing enough right now. One of the things that I'm helping some other districts with, which I think would be very helpful here and in other areas as well, is creating a system of supports for students that's very similar to what you hear about academics with the multi-tiered system of support. The first level is actually understanding what kids are experiencing and giving some kind of universal screener to understand if they might be struggling with some mental health issues, and also providing basic curriculum to students at every level to understand the signs of mental health distress and where to go to get help. That extends to helping our staff understand that and understand how to help kids. And helping parents. We need a second level where if we identify kids that have some initial issues that could be helped by school counselors, we make sure they're getting help. And then we have a third level, which really needs to be developed with the community, of having those school counselors and staff knowing the signs, being able to refer those to school counselors, and then having the school counselors talk to parents and connect those students with a behavioral health professional in the community. We have to stop stigmatizing mental health, and we have to create a system where people can actually access the support they need.
Andrea Engelken-Cervenka. In terms of strategy, the first thing, working with mental health professionals and the Diversity and Inclusion Committee to make sure our kids have been, and when I say our, I say the community, just to be clear, my husband and I don't have children. We love kids anyway. I think it's really important that children feel safe enough to be able to say what's going on, and I think that there needs to be strategies that emphasize that every single person has their own identity and a story, and they need to have respect and a place in our community and they need to be able to focus and learn while they're in the classrooms, and they need to be able to form bonds with their teachers and fellow students to be able to do things in the community that enrich them, whether it's to play football or do an art club or anything else that they value. As Katie says, it's incredibly important that our kids succeed and actually get the skills that they need regardless. Literacy, math, how to receive positive attention instead of negative attention. We all have to learn these things, and we can't have, you know, too many disruptions at the expense of the fellow students. So let's make sure that the teachers are well-equipped to handle a wide variety, and let's do some icebreakers that are made to break that isolation up with mental health professionals that make it safe and fun for kids to get to know each other at the beginning of the year that professionals can glean some real information from.
Courtney Jane Hockman. If you've seen any of my materials, my campaign slogan is inclusion for success. And that's because I believe that our students, our faculty, and our staff cannot be successful at learning, at teaching, at supporting, if they're in places where they don't feel included. Diversity exists, and Manhattan is a uniquely diverse place because of where all of our families come from. And I think sometimes we forget that, just because you're not seeing it every day, just because it's not necessarily a visual diversity. So I think we need to be intentional in creating spaces in our buildings where everyone feels included and valued and respected. As others have mentioned, you don't have to like everything, but empathy is important. It is an important skill for being a good human. It is an important skill for, you know, when we talk about social emotional learning in school, being tolerant, being empathetic. And so just creating spaces and respecting spaces that students are seeking out, like GSA clubs, for example, they saw a need. They've got people who also saw it. They got a faculty member to support it. That's what they have shown us. So letting students figure stuff out and just making space and being inclusive, so, you know, talking about different cultural holidays, not just one. Thank you.
Kurt Herman. So I guess I like to start with something I always like to point out. You know, diversity is not about race. It's tall kids, short kids. It's special ed kids. And, you know, we have a committee for diversity and inclusion also in the district that was formed several years ago. And that group is working very hard towards working with the different types of diverse students and making sure that the schools are having a diversity programs and that they're aware of different things like different holidays and also I think, you know, having a partnership with some of the local groups would be helpful, like True Colors, which is a group for LGBTQ students, and I think that's very important. And, you know, and then there's also, like, you know, if you can kind of look at what other districts do too, like Lawrence School District, you know, I mean, I think we need to do a better job of, I guess, recruiting diverse staff. We don't have one black teacher at the high school. I think that's, you know, but it's kind of hard to get those teachers to come here and you know, like, but like Lawrence School District, they have a teachers of color group and also a parents of color group, and they go out and do recruiting trips to try and bring in different types of teachers to come to our district. So I think those are some good approaches, and I think we're doing a pretty good job right now with our Committee of Diversity and Inclusion.
Frank Beer. Absolutely every child at every grade level deserves respect, and we should treat everyone that, knowing that we have unnumbered different diverse characteristics, and that's what makes us human, that's what makes us wonderful. And we need to meet those needs of each individual, but we need to do it in a way that is not, and this is an area where I feel strongly, that is not segmenting our population. I feel that is becoming an issue, that we're identifying more and more groups, and I believe that by recognizing that everyone deserves respect where they are, where they're going, that's what's most important. And the more lines we draw, the tougher it makes that job.
Thanks, Rob Busby. First, I want to say that I would really like if our state legislature would be able to fully fund special education. That would be a huge plus, I think, when we talk about some groups. Every student and every person in our district is a human being worthy of dignity, respect. They are a person of worth. And I think that's important that we focus on that and that we remember that when we're doing our teaching. I'm going to piggyback on what Katie said about behavioral health or mental health. I think we need to not stigmatize that. I think it's important. I look forward to a day when we do treat mental health the same way we treat our physical health. She mentioned annual checkups, and that's exactly what I think we should do, is have an annual checkup. Go in and find out, is everything okay? Because you might not know, just like you might not know you have cancer festering until you go and get a checkup, early detection. And then be able to have good, ready access. And I think the school can do partnerships with outside organizations. They already have some. To be able to get to that so that we can get students the acute care they need. Make sure our faculty have good, solid training, improved, you know, continuing ed that they get toward those sorts of things to recognize the signs. It's all about the learning environment. In a good learning environment, we'll have better school safety with better mental health. We'll have better classroom behaviors, which will lead to better student success and better faculty retention.
This is Kristen Brighton. First of all, this has been a great discussion. Obviously, this is a table full of people who believe in diversity and equity and inclusion, so we should be in good hands moving forward. I don't have too much more to add that they haven't hit on, other than I fully believe we need to continue to look for new resources for professional development to bring into our schools. We're very limited in how much time we have each year for professional development, so we have to be very, very particular and stingy and balance all the different things we need to teach our professionals, but continuing to teach our teachers how to be culturally responsive, how to meet students where they are, to meet their needs, to be empathetic. All of those are things we need to continually remind teachers who are experienced teachers. It never hurts anyone to get a little bit of a reminder about some of those things now and then. So PD is extremely important. It's been an emphasis for the board for several years that the district continue to work hard to recruit and retain people of color and all different types of backgrounds and nationalities. There's all kinds of data that proves that students learn better when they see some teachers and adults in their building who look like them, regardless of whatever their background is. So we need to continue to work hard so that we can have good representation, as others have mentioned. And then lastly, I mean, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If kids don't feel safe, if they aren't fed, if they aren't clothed, if they don't have shelter, they're not going to learn. So we need to make sure we're creating a warm, welcoming environment where students feel loved, they feel cared for. I mean, we're going to be tough on them, too. They still have to do their homework. But certainly they need to feel like they're in a place where they are accepted for who they are. Otherwise, they will not be successful with their academics.
All right, I'm going to make a public service announcement real fast to remind everybody there are 4 seats open. So as you're deciding who to vote for, you got 4 spots. All right, I'm going to change up topics here just a little bit and talk about, this question is about credentialing. And we would like to know, what is your position on meeting our need for educators through alternative credentialing? And I believe we start with Ms. Allen on this one. The question is about alternative credentialing as a way of meeting the need for educators in the district.
Yes, this is Katie, and you'd have to tell me a little bit more about what specific alternative credentialing you're talking about, but I think it's definitely necessary. What we're seeing nationwide is there is, one, a teacher shortage. Many of those folks who've been in the profession are frankly fed up, and they're leaving, and they're going to find other jobs. But the difficulty is we actually don't have a pipeline of people interested in the teaching profession to fill those right now because of, again, a lot of it is pay and the way we're treating the profession as a whole. People just aren't interested in going into being a teacher because they might not want to get yelled at or told what to do every moment of the day. So one of the things that we do need to do is think about alternative ways to get into the classroom. You'll see there are various programs at Kansas State University to get folks in. There are opportunities we're working at other levels. Specifically, one of the things that I've been helping with is at the state level development of a registered teacher apprenticeship program. And that that specifically targets paras who are currently working in the classroom, because we know those folks want to be there. They already have relationships with kids. They can deal with some of the behavior things that a lot of teachers don't get that training for. So we need to find other ways to encourage folks. Some of that is also reducing the barriers to getting educated and getting in the classroom. So I think there's a lot of alternative things that should be looked at to build the pipeline and also make sure that folks who want to be in that system have the opportunity to get there.
Andrea Engel, Conservanca. I thought since I was further up on the queue, I'd have the original thing, but I immediately think about the paraprofessionals. When it comes to special education, if paraprofessionals are earning less than $15 an hour and it's already difficult enough, the burnout is incredible. My mother, who's here, is a freshly retired CNA, and the bottom line is it takes a lot of work, and I think that we need to look at the Kansas Department of Health to perhaps try to find some kind of partnerships or any kind of monies or grants that might be available to start looking upwards towards the state level to get more help locally, and that way we can actually show up at board meetings or attend the legislation sessions by Zoom and start making our voice heard as a community that, hey, we need resources here. This has been hard on everybody, and we need a little bit more help. And that might not sound like alternative credentials, but the bottom line is I think we need to start going outside of the city and get some help.
Courtney Jane Hockman. So I have a mixed answer about this one, and part of it is because of personal experience. I think that there are avenues where we can support teachers who are in the pipeline and being able to give them grants or some sort of educational subsidies if they already have, like, a content-level degree. However, there are some areas where alternative credentials are problematic. My son, when we returned to in-person learning, he had three big transitions. He was going to a new school because they just moved the sixth grade up to the middle school. People were still getting ill a lot, so there was a lot of turnover, a lot of absences. And he had a teacher who was a brand new teacher who did not have a special education background. And he was quickly moved to a different position because it was not appropriate. So, yeah, you know, a math teacher that has a degree in math but not a teaching certification, sure, let's support you. We can teach you. We can have mentorship from other teachers in the district. Absolutely. Things like special education, especially when it comes to high need, autism specialists, behavior, it's a little trickier. You know, as we start investigating these things, if there are options for specific programs like that, I would obviously be open to it. K-State is actually expanding programs to get more people in the pipeline, specifically with early childhood ed and K-State land grant push to attract new students. So I'm hopeful we'll get more.
Good finish.
Excuse me.
Kurt Herman. So to answer the question about licensure, I agree with that 100%. But I also agree that, I mean, it is a slippery slope. And I think at the secondary level, it's okay. You know, like Mr. Beer could go in, and I think he would be a good business teacher at the high school level. But I think at the grade school level, that's a lot different, requires a different skill set, and then special ed. And you know, part of the answer, though, I think, you know, is, I mean, that's it. I'm a huge fan of the Grow Your Own program. Topeka, they have a program where if you go through the career technical ed program through the high school, and then when you graduate, they'll offer you a contract. And if you come back and teach after you get out of graduate from college, I guarantee you a job here. And I think that also helps us with our minority, increasing our minority staff as well. So, and also too, you know, making sure we have a great place to work here too, you know, competitive salary and a place that people want to come and work. So that'll help fill those positions as well.
You kind of have stole my thunder, Kurt. This is Frank Beer. And just for a reference, I did teach elementary level junior achievement classes for 6 years in the early 2000s. So there are some unique programs, and that's what I had written down in advance here, is there are some opportunities. I think we have to get creative. There are colleges that offer accelerated degrees, and for those that don't know, if you've got life experience, you can take classes that fill in the gaps, and they will give you course credit for life experience, and maybe the schools could help contract with folks like that to help encourage them to do that. Another area, we've got our military nearby. I think there's a, you know, recruiting in from that, and again, looking for opportunities. Maybe somebody has doesn't have a teaching degree, but they can get those necessary credits in a quick way. So I think it's going to take some creativity. I'm not sure I'm for someone coming in without credentials and teaching. I think there's got to be some level, but I think we can get creative in using past life experience to take someone who is there, has many life skills, and give them the technical training they need to manage as an educator.
Thanks. Rob Busby here. I really think alternative credentialing, it depends entirely on what we're talking about. That's already been touched on. Kurt hit it right on the head there. I have an occupational instructor certification. I can walk into any Florida high school and teach within my field. Not a problem. Could be a little more challenging here in Kansas. So there are some things we could do. However, Rob Busby probably isn't prepared to go teach in second grade classrooms. I was the president of Future Teachers of America in high school, and that was my dream at that time, was to go teach in second grade classrooms. And it just didn't work out. I ended up joining the military instead. So there are some great programs, or were some great programs. We had the Troops to Teachers program that I think dried up. I'm not sure it even exists anymore. There are a lot of other things we can do out there. We talked about hit on the idea of possibly making a pipeline straight out of high school for students that are inspired like I was. Give them opportunities. Have means to repay that education. These are things probably outside the scope of this board here. But when it comes to alternative credentialing, Courtney's right too. There are some cases where it won't work out, where you just don't want to necessarily put someone in that job. But there are places where we can use it, and where we can use it to the best effect of the students and their academic outcomes, I think we should. It's the only the right thing to do for those students.
Kristen Brighton. This is going to become a growing and ongoing issue, as we've all touched upon. We were very lucky this year in USD 383. We filled all except for three of our licensed positions. Those were three SPED positions that they've struggled to fill for many years. And usually they are in classrooms with the highest needs kids. They have the hardest time to get those positions filled. There are districts in the state, though, that are basically to the point where they have to hire any warm body that will take the job to work in there, regardless of their background and their skill. There are districts in the state who are going overseas and recruiting people and bringing them to the United States, helping them get their visas because they need trained teachers. We're going to have to continue to look at alternatives, so continuing to work with the state and work at licensing, exploring credentials. I heard a presentation this week about the registered apprenticeship program. It's not a great solution for everybody. Ideally, we would rather all of our students came straight out of a four-year university and walked into our classrooms, but sometimes when you're desperate, you're going to have to start to get creative. And whether you have a class of, there are times where we have had in our district where there have not been enough subs, where one teacher takes two classrooms. So it's like 45 kids. That's one of those desperate measures. That's not an ideal, but those are one of those times where every once in a while something like that has to happen. So we're going to have to continue to have a good relationship with the State Department of Education and continue to look for additional ways to get people the training that they need to get them in our classrooms.
Greg Hoyt, and ultimately credentialing is going to come from the State Department. And Kent State University, at the direction of Dean Mercer, has really partnered well with the State Department to explore this area of credentialing. I never thought I would see the day where I thought teacher shortage might become an issue in Manhattan, Kansas, with Kent State University in our backyard. But it's here. But the needs here are vastly different than they are in western Kansas. And Topeka has to handle all of those issues together. So I am fully supportive of finding alternative ways to credential qualified individuals to get into the classroom. Fort Hays State is doing a great job. Emporia State has programs. Kansas State, I'm sure University of Kansas does. I can't speak to it directly. But ultimately, there needs to be some guidance from higher institutions of higher education, because I think educators in the classroom need to have an exposure to educational psychology. So no, I don't think anybody can just walk in off the street and be a teacher. There's a lot to it. Ultimately, the state will credential. I think we've got a wonderful opportunity for second career individuals to teach in our community. This is a great retirement place. A lot of people come to Fort Riley, and they fall in love with Manhattan, and they stay here. And they've got 20 years of work life left. So let's find a way to get the good ones into our classroom.
All right, thank you. This next question comes from the audience, and it may sound a little bit like we've gone back in time on this question. This question is actually about the mascot. What is your understanding of the Manhattan community's desire to change the mascot at the high school?
Andrea Engelken-Cervenka. My understanding is that back in 2017, the students voted to keep the mascot, and the board made a decision to keep it, but also to expand education and about Native American cultures and their current cultures as well. And so at this point in time, I would just go ahead and let it be, because I think we've got bigger fish to fry, respectfully, and that's my position.
So my Courtney Jane Hockman. So the students voted in 2017 to change the mascot to the Wolves, and that never happened. That aside, we're at a time where land recognitions have finally become something mainstream. Most times when you go to a meeting or a conference, there's a land recognition. That cannot be taken away from the history of our United States. I personally think that when we're also in a time where schools across the country are considering the change, making the change, our professional sports teams are making the change, that we should be respectful of not only Native Americans who see this as offensive and an offensive imagery, but also letting our students create their own culture, and they're making meaning out of a new symbol and a new tradition.
Kurt Herman, well, I've been on the board long enough now. This has actually come up two times in my tenure. You know, the last time that we approached this, we spent two full years on this, had discussions at almost every board meeting, and we had a public hearing. And if you probably remember, I had a full house at Rezac and had the community come in, and we took public comment, and you know, we came up with a solution to name part of the high school after Coach Prentip, that's where the Indian came from, and it's a symbol, not a mascot, but regardless, whatever you want to call it, but you know, we named part of the commons after in honor of Frank Prentip, so it was the Frank Prentip Commons. We also have been developing some curriculum about educating the students about the Native American and the Indian, and also, you know, our Committee for Diversity and Inclusion was reformed as a result of that, and the CDI, the Committee for Diversity and Inclusion, also, we've kind of eliminated the things like at the grade school, like for Thanksgiving, that we don't speak so much or have them portray Indians or do anything like that was traditionally done when I was a kid. But to answer the question, yes, I think we should keep the symbol of the Indian at the high school.
Okay. Frank Beer. I've been public on this before. I've spoken to the board several times directly. I've been quoted in the local media. I feel strongly that the Indian should be kept, and the reason is this, is I attended the civic engagement group that's helping here today held a discussion period. There was a very telling moment in that discussion when in our, we had different breakouts, and in our breakout, one of the biggest proponents of removing the mascot, which happens to be a Kent State professor who is not from here, has only relatively recently moved here. There was a statement made. They said, when the kids see that, they hear this. And it came to me, the only place that I hear derogatory statements regarding the Indians are on those who want to remove it. I feel strongly that those that want to keep it have a reverence, a pride, and they are very much respectful of the Indian image. Also, I've been somewhat critical. The school did pass. They're supposed to have a curriculum in place. I do realize COVID got in the way a bit, but we need to have that training that that the school district did commit to. We need to get that in place. I think that's a good thing, and I'm totally in favor of keeping the Indian and respecting the Indian.
Rob Busby. So the question was about my understanding of the community's desire to change the mascot or the imagery. And I'll tell you, the board has been asked and answered this question with the community multiple times. And best I can gather, the community's pretty sharply divided. There are some people in the community, including people of indigenous backgrounds, who strongly support keeping the Indian. There are people of indigenous backgrounds who strongly support changing that. And the reality is, that's the one thing, and I've heard it said, hey, look, if it's this much of a problem, it keeps coming up and it keeps coming up, why don't we just change it and get it over with? And I'm just not sure that's the appropriate way to govern, make decisions, or to teach children. What I will say is that the one thing we can all agree on is that when over two-thirds of our kids at the eighth grade level are not reading at the eighth grade level, are not proficient in English, language arts, or mathematics, our focus needs to be on that. And that's where we should be drawing until such time as we make some significant headway there. This is a question we need to let the community continue to evolve and work through.
Could start this in many different ways. This woman here in the front row asked us this question at a different forum earlier this year, and I loved how she asked it, and I've quoted this many, many times. She said, are there more important things for us to be talking about than the mascot? And I said, yes, there are. However, we just a few minutes ago all talked up and down this table about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and when I look at the notes that I wrote for myself, they all kind of still relate to this issue. We need to create an environment where we can recruit and retain people of color to work in our buildings. We need to create environments where all feel welcome, safe, welcome, and heard. There are a lot of people in this community who absolutely feel that the Indian should never be changed. There are people in this community who think it's the biggest travesty of all time. We are never going to come to an agreement on it. I can literally pull out a newspaper from December of 1992 when I was a student at Manhattan High School that I wrote an article about this. We have spent so much time over the last, well, all the time Kurt's been on the board, so many hours talking about this issue, and it's a cloud over us no matter what we're talking about. We had to replace the turf at Bishop Stadium this year. We had the money. It wasn't a debate about how much it was going to cost. It was whether or not to put Manhattan in both end zones or to do Manhattan or Indians. And we spent an hour of our night talking about that instead of things that are probably truthfully more important to academic outcomes. So if the board decides to take this issue up again, I want to hear from our students. But ultimately, I'm ready to move on. Thank you.
Greg Hoyt, and I was intimately involved in the last decision. This is what I would say. I'm very familiar with the work of Dr. Alex Redcorn at Kent State University and the recommendation to school districts from our state board of education. Having said that, I've had many conversations with the family of Frank Prentup, and I know what this means to that man's family. And the individual responsible for the artwork that sits prominently displayed as you drive west up Points Avenue towards Manhattan High School was done by a very good friend and colleague of mine, Brett Yancey, who was of Native American descent. And I know strongly how Brent and his family felt on that issue. So in this regard, I would ultimately support wholeheartedly the decision made by the Board of Education, but my vote will be to retain the Indians.
Katie Allen, and a lot has already been said on the topic, and I don't have too much more, but I'll go back to the understanding of how the community feels about the issue and exactly what everybody says, very divisive. You know, you have a lot of people on the side of it is time to change because nationwide we're looking at change. And as mentioned, we talked about culturally responsive pedagogy and what is the perception from people outside that don't understand the history of where our mascot came from. The only thing that is different that I would add is actually it's a longer running issue. If you go to, I think it's the MHS alumni page, this is maybe since the 30s or 40s been something that has been talked about and never resolved. I would like to focus on more important issues as other people have brought up because just rehashing the Indian mascot is not going to get us anywhere further in making sure our kids can read and write and that they're doing well in math. But one thing that I think is important, because we've talked about respect and helping ensure that we're being respectful and not offensive of people, is what Mr. Hoyt said. We do have to recognize where our mascot came from. But as others have said, there was a promise made at that last discussion about either creating or adopting a curriculum about Native American history and culture. And that promise has never been fulfilled. And until that's done, I don't think that the board should take up any kind of vote about mascot change or keeping it.
All right, thank you. All right, so this next question looks like we're moving down one. This one is about relationships. How can relationships among and between administrators, teachers, students, families, and the community at large be maintained or improved? How can relationships among and between administrators, teachers, students, families, and the community at large be maintained and improved? And can you offer a specific suggestion?
Courtney Jane Hockman, that is a large question.
I didn't write that one either.
No, and it's one that I appreciate because there's been a lot of discussion and questions about parent involvement, but I think you bring up, this question brings up the bigger picture of everyone. Building relationships is hard. And, you know, in an effort to not be segmented, we have to remember that these are our public schools. These schools are in our communities. They're in our neighborhoods. And so even if you don't have kids, you should try to get involved. You can serve on a site council and see what's going on, you know, what innovative things and interesting things and events are going on at the school nearest you. You can, if you have children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, what have you, good friends. Hey, Uncle Kevin. You know, you can get involved. There's no line that says you can't come here because you don't have a student here. As far as between administration and teachers and staff and students, there just needs to be more conversations, more open doors, more places where people know that conversation and questions are welcome. And I think, you know, not everyone has the time to ask every question, but you can find out who you need to go to, whether it's a lower level and a parent talking to that teacher.
Kurt Herman, the structure we have now, there's so many opportunities for parents to get involved and volunteer at the schools and including the community at large. We have site councils at every school, every building, and those are part of the administration. There's teachers. There's also community members that sit on those site councils. The PTOs are also the same thing, you know, always looking for volunteers. And, you know, and I found from my experience when I was the PTO president in Amanda Arnold, you know, I could raise money like crazy. It's easy to write a check. and walk away. But, you know, if we had like a, when you always have like a cleanup night where, you know, bring a rake and come and help us clean up school grounds, there'd be three parents would show up. Some schools would have a lot more parents show up for different things like that. But, you know, there's lots of opportunities. And, you know, we also have parent-teachers conferences. And I think they're very well attended. I think we have like a well over 90% attendance by our parents that come in and talk to the teachers. So I think that's very important as well. But, yeah, there's plenty of opportunities. And, you know, and a good education starts at home, too, you know. So parental involvement is extremely important to an education of a child. So I think we got a good structure in place, and I think we just, you know, keep volunteering.
Frank Beer. It gets to communication. I think the school has done it. I'm interested with the student and parent square programs, which are going to help with communicating with parents. We have to also realize that we have a behemoth in town that sucks the energy out, and that's Kansas State. Our school district is not as much the center of the community as it is in many communities, particularly smaller communities, strictly because there's so much energy going there, and that's not a bad thing. It just is. It's something we have to recognize. But if we have as open communication as we can between parents, teachers, administrators, and the community as a whole, we give opportunity for those. As Kurt said, we get, from my understanding, is we get great participation in parent-teacher conferences, which I think is a very good sign. And we have to continue to be very open and robust about our communication with all of the parties, including the community.
Rob Busby. So I agree. Communication is absolutely key. And it really comes down to being able to get that other 10%. Kurt said we have 90% participation in parent-teacher conferences. And I gather that falls off quite a bit when you get into the secondary levels. It really comes down to finding out how we're going to encourage parent involvement. Rethink parent-teacher conferences and find ways to incentivize that last 10% to be involved, because ultimately it's not just communication, it's trust. Parents trust their teachers. Parents trust broadly the system until they don't, until they think that there's something going on. And oftentimes you find that there's maybe some rumor or some one-off situation that has been completely misconstrued. And that does come down to communication. I think the current administration and district does a good job of communication. And we have a lot of new tools that have already been mentioned to do that, to communicate with parents. The question now is, again, getting to that last 10%. And, you know, I kind of wrote down here, it's like, well, maybe we give parents a participation grade. I had some other crazy ideas, too. I've got lots of crazy ideas. I think one of them, I got like 10 seconds left. One of them was something like, hey, let's tell parents we're going to ban book A and do an A-B test. The B side, we'll tell them we're going to introduce book B, some made-up book, and see who all shows up. I guarantee you get 100%.
Overall, our district does a great job with communications. I think people just need to decide if they're listening or not. There are more tools to communicate with people today than there certainly were when I was in school and when my mother was in school and moving back through time. If you want to get a hold of somebody, we are more in a situation where we're frustrated if they don't get back to us in 10 minutes. So I don't think that is an issue. I think what we need to do is to try to inspire and instill in our families and that desire to be involved. And as Rob said, my crazy idea, so I've been sitting on the site council for Frank Bergman and Northview for the last 2 years. Those are both big schools, like 400 some students. We're lucky to get 6 parents to show up to site council meetings. And I think a lot of it was during COVID when for 2 years families really weren't welcome in the buildings. We really, just because we were trying to keep down the numbers of human beings in our buildings to keep viruses down, we didn't allow people in, and so families got out of the habit. So I think we're, as a district, and I think this is less of a board issue and probably more of a school leadership issue in each of our buildings, going to have to continue to work hard to inspire and excite and explain to parents why it's important for them to be involved, how students whose parents are involved in their education have better educational outcomes. So I'm hoping that we can turn that around. I think the board can be cheerleaders and encourage that. but I don't know how much from the board table we can do that other than be good role models ourselves and continue to share and encourage and celebrate people who do so.
Yeah, Greg Hoyt, and relationships are critical. And so I agree with Rob that at the center of relationships is trust. And the best way to build trust is to align your actions with what your words are. Now, I think we were all created with two ears and one mouth, and so those should be used in direct proportion to one another. I'm going to date myself a little bit, but one of the frameworks during my tenure as principal was I relied heavily on Stephen Covey and the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And I think that work is timeless. I don't think it's outdated. And one of the tenets there was seek first to understand before being understood. And that's something that I think we all can model with each other, and certainly would be something that I would do as a Board of Education member. I may not agree with you, but I will listen to you. And if I disagree with you, I promise to disagree with you agreeably.
Katie Allen, I think there's been a lot of great things said here about improving relationships, but I'm going to go with two specific things to share. I do think there is more improved communication that we could give. As I've been out talking to voters, there is a lot of mistrust about what's happening in public schools based on national media and things that really aren't happening here, but there's no kids in the school, so there's just no connection, and so they're believing everything that they're hearing on the news. One thing that I think we could do to improve locally what's happening is sharing a little bit more communication around how the actions we're taking align to our strategic framework and how those are actually going to improve things for students and teachers and the community at large. The other example that I think would be an area that the school board could think about in parent engagement is to take a look at some of the policies that affect parents, and I'll give you one specific. This fall and last spring, there was a lot of talk about chronic absenteeism in our schools, not just in Manhattan, but nationwide. We have a policy right now, sure, to make sure we get kids back, but it really penalizes them and is punitive and tells them if they don't come back, we're going to call the police on you. What we could be doing is looking at those policies and changing them and thinking, like, actually, how can we support families? How can we make sure that the kids have what they need to actually get back into the classroom? What can we do individually to make sure that everything's working well for you and that school is safe, a good environment, and you want to be there? So I think there are some specific things that the board can do. Thank you.
Andrea Engelken-Cervenka. At the heart of this is what's at the heart of public education. That's children from early on all the way to young adults. When a student walks from whatever home life they have and they make it into that school, whoever they interact with there, whether it's a teacher, whether it's the student resource officer, whether it was my gifted student teacher who pulled me aside and said, "Are you doing okay?" Whatever is going on, we now have the technology in place to be able to do some more things in real time, because as a community member, I'm concerned about our students having feeling safe, being healthy, and I'm worried about making sure that they're getting what they need, and I'm worried as a community member about the where the money's going, and so that's part of it. I think a lot of people are, because we're about to get a 14% increase. There are twice a month, the registers are given out, and a monthly review just so people can be comfortable with where things are going and have a say. And everybody said what's important. There are so many opportunities, the on-site councils, the board meetings. And the bottom line is communication is always a two-way street. And if these kids don't feel safe to even talk about what's going on, then the communication breaks down. And if that happens inside the school, then the family and the parents suffer. And so, thank you.
All right, guys, there's only time for two more questions. Aw, it's a bummer. And after these next two questions, then you'll be given a chance for your closing comments. But Kurt gets to start with this next one. And this question is about skills alignment. Many economic experts contend, Many economic experts contend there is a skills misalignment between graduates and job openings. How can USD 383 help create better alignment in the Manhattan region? How can 383 help create better alignment in the Manhattan region between skills and jobs?
I'll pass. I'm kidding. No. Excuse me. Well, I think really the center of that answer would be is there through our career and technical education program that we have, you know, and there's also life skills. I know Kristen, got to give Kristen Brighton, you know, that's something that she's been working on too, and I'm a champion of that as well. But, you know, I mean, if we graduate a student out of Manhattan High School, I don't consider that we're successful. I want to see what that student is doing 5 years from now. And that doesn't necessarily mean college anymore. You know, I mean, I think, you know, just to give you somewhat of a graphic, you know, for every 10 college graduates now, there's one job available. But for every one VOTEC or, you know, technical type graduate, there's 10 jobs. So I think, you know, as long, I think we should make sure we continue to focus and expand work release, I don't know if that's the right term, but, I don't know. There you go. Thank you. Yeah. You know, work-based learning, you know, we're working with the chamber and, you know, so give students an opportunity to go out. We have quite a few students that do that now, but I think expanding and continue to grow that program, is a huge step in that direction.
Frank Beer. Yes, I agree with Kurt. There's been a turn. I mean, some years ago, the message coming out of the school tended to be, if you don't go to college, you're a failure. And that's at least how the kids took it, whether it was intended or not. That is obviously turning. I call that the microization of the situation. I give Mike Rowe a lot of credit for that. There's dignity, honor, and all work. Not every student is necessarily, set up for college. Our college is not a good step, at least out of high school, for many students. We need to have a robust relationship with our technical schools. We need to have a robust relationship with the chamber, as I know that's been worked on. I think that could be improved. And we need to identify, help kids so that when they are finishing up in high school, that they're ready to make a decision about where they want to take the next stage in their life, and we need to prepare them for each of those stages. I think that's being done, but that is always something we'll continue to work to improve upon, and it's a worthy goal.
Rob Busby. So I'm going to take a slightly different tack on that. First, I was the kid who wasn't ready to go to college out of high school when I graduated with my, I'm not even sure it's legal to say, GPA. They might revoke my diploma. So, no, I did graduate from Manhattan High. I promise I did. But when I did finally go to college that first time, I spent two glorious semesters at Kansas State University. It was a lot of fun. Most of the credits didn't transfer, but it was a lot of fun. The reality, though, when we look at what we've got going on, if you look at numbers from ETS, that's the American Council on Education, and the Carnegie Education Foundation for Advancement of Teaching, and the College Entrance Examination Board, they kind of put together a coalition. They said that their survey of employers shows that 50% of millennials are unable to effectively apply literacy or math skills in the workplace. So that's a big, big challenge that we have to overcome. And the only place you overcome those, really honestly, is in your K through 6 years. But you've got to make sure you catch that before you get out the door. 1.7 million first-year college students need remedial help, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. And 65% of our fourth graders are not proficient in reading. 59% are not performing grade level in math. That's fourth graders. You should be reading by the fourth grade. Those are the things we need to get after. And it's great that we have all this career and technical education stuff. That's going to be important. That's going to take care of employers. But the reality is we've got 14 million jobs that are going to disappear in 10 years. And those people are going to need to be able to learn new skills.
I totally agree with everyone that we have a huge skills misalignment in the state of Kansas and in our community. I live and breathe this every day. It's a huge part of the work I do professionally. I'm going to use my time to talk about an idea I have as to how USD 383 can be a partner in local economic development efforts. Manhattan has really hung its future goals in economic development into trying to expand our capacity, building upon K-State strengths in biomanufacturing, bioscience, biosecurity, all of those fields that are emphasized through MBAF, through the work that K-State researchers are doing at the Biosecurity Research Institute. I took a trip with the chamber to Oklahoma City last year in which we toured an aviation academy. They consider themselves the heart of aviation. I believe we need to become the heart of biomanufacturing and biosciences and life sciences. And I'd like to see us partner with K-State and MATC to build a life sciences academy. I think it's a win-win. I think we can build up our workforce. We can get more young people prepared to go into careers in health sciences and in research, life sciences, biosciences, and so forth. I think we also have a building with 2,000 students in it. Okay, 1975 with the September 20th count. That's just about maxed. If we could build a separate facility that students could apply to go to get a head start on their career in the sciences, life sciences, and healthcare, whatever, I think it would be a great way to depopulate Manhattan High School and prepare a percentage of our students for the workforce in the area that Manhattan has put its future economic development stars into. So I'm excited to talk about that at our upcoming board retreat and over the next few years. I think it's a big idea. It's going to take us 10 years, but we got to get started now.
Greg Hoyt, and in 2015, Commissioner Watson and others at the State Department of Ed went on a statewide listening tour. And out of that, not just talking with educators, talking with community members, talking with business members. And out of that came the Kansans Can Vision. And the idea was to redefine what student success looks like. Yes, test scores are important, but educational success is way more than just a test score. And the motto was, Kansas leads the world in the educational success of students. And I was so energized when I walked out of that statewide meeting and came back to my faculty and said, you know what, if Kansas leads the world, then I want Manhattan to lead the state of Kansas. And we're not there yet. But I think we've done incredible things. We've greatly enhanced the relationship with Manhattan Area Technical College. Manhattan is a unique community. Manhattan is not Garden City. And so what does it look like for Garden City versus what does it look like in Manhattan, Kansas? We've got a lot of students that are wanting and ready for higher education, but higher education is not for all. And we are doing things, not just at the high school, but in the district, to make sure that the alignment is there. We're not there. And I'm going to get 100% behind what you want to do to enhance that, Kristen. Great idea.
Katie Allen. I also think there's some great ideas we've already heard, but one of the things that I wrote about when we were asked this question by the chamber is not forgetting that it is a systems perspective. We have several new early learning centers because we've realized in the past decade or so how important that focus on early learning before you get to kindergarten is there. The other thing that I want to correct is I think we really should be having kids read by second grade. Fourth grade is too late, so we do need to put an emphasis on literacy at the early grades. As Mr. Hoyt mentioned, the Kansans Can, when they went and talked to people across the state, one of the biggest skills mismatch was what we call soft skills. So they were getting people that don't know how to work with others, people that can't communicate, people that don't even show up. So when you talk about what's happening in the schools with social-emotional learning curriculum, there's a lot of criticism, but those are the skills that are being taught because businesses have told us that that's what kids are really missing. The academic stuff is probably okay, could be better, but it really is the soft skills that they're expecting schools to work with students today now. The other thing, too, as was mentioned, the career and technical education is huge, and Manhattan has done a very good job of getting those programs started at the high school level. We need to make sure we maintain that relationship with Manhattan Area Technical College and the specifics about skills alignment. We should be asking those industries that employ large groups of people, what are the skills that they actually need? Do they have professionals that can help us in the classrooms impart some of those skills on students? And not just think that it should be left to our local public school system.
Andrea Engelken-Cervenka, this to me feels a little bit like a cart before the horse issue. If kids cannot read, if they cannot do basic math, then we've got problems no matter what job they're in. They are teaching themselves just fine on their smartphones and their tabs. They are self-taught techies. and they will easily learn in any field of interest that they have. And I think we need to be looking at age-appropriate screenings for children's skills and interests so we can both identify their strengths and look at their gaps. And if a kid wants to pick up a wrench and go mess around, let him go mess around with the wrench. Make sure the first graders get out to their Milford Nature field trip so the ones that are interested in animal care or veterinary medicine can get that first taste, which is so important. Let's make sure these kids function before we think about what jobs they're going to have, and that means they have to have the skills, and they will learn those soft skills if they have a good structure, how to just like we all had to do. So I call it functional compassion, and that we need some good support for their skills and interests.
Courtney Jane Hockman. Katie stole some of my thunder because I was trying to find a non-tech comment to make. So, yes, a lot of the things where we talk about social-emotional learning, which has kind of become a buzzword that some people aren't comfortable about and are uncertain what that means, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about punctuality. We're talking about how people relate to other people, good communication, empathy, the things that you do in a job besides what they train you to do. Because you can get on-the-job training in a lot of fields, but if you don't know how to relate to other people, how to work cooperatively, it's just not going to happen. I'm on the Governor's Committee for Early Education, and they are really trying to set up new things where they can identify needs of these children earlier. And these statistics about fourth graders' reading levels and math levels, we have to stop and consider what this means. This is a nationwide issue because those students were in kindergarten when COVID hit. And so similar to my son, who was in his second year of preschool when COVID hit, they have different deficits. Not all families could stay at home and facilitate their students' learning and read to them and do math problems and things like that. There were parents that were, required to keep working, our essential personnel. There are single parents. There were all sorts of dynamics. There were, some families got sicker than others, but yes. So, yes, we need to concentrate on both.
Okay, this is our last question. We're going to start with Mr. Beer at the end, and then after that, we'll do closing comments for 2 minutes. This seems to me to be a little bit different tone of a question. It's a little bit more philosophical than some of the others. It did come from the audience. And this one is, what is the most important concept or idea, in your view, that a teacher should impart on his or her students? What do you think is the most important concept or idea that a teacher should impart on their students?
Frank Beer. I think a sense of self-worth and pride in self, pride in a good sense, because if you feel good and if you are if you have pride in your own self, then you're going to care about pretty much everything. You're going to care about learning. You're going to care about being nice. You're going to care about that. So keeping having teachers that can make kids feel good about themselves is going to have a good waterfall effect in pretty much everything else that they do. And I think the best teachers that I remember were the ones that made me feel the best about myself. And the challenge where the really great teachers are is they're able to do it. They're facing 20, 25 students, and they're able to do it with all of them, and they're all different. So it is probably the biggest challenge they have, but it's also, I think, the most important philosophical approach.
Ooh, I like pedestrian philosophy. Rob Busby. So I would say the most important would be how to think, and especially how to think critically so that you can learn, so you can analyze new sources of information, so you can reevaluate the things that you think you know, the things that you think you believe, so that you can validate those things you believe. Make sure that those kids know how to think. Everything else that follows will enable their learning
that will take them through life and be good citizens who can evaluate what they're receiving when it comes to what anyone's telling them, whether it be an employer, whether it be the news, whether it be any other source of information they're receiving. Friends and family want to tell you something. You know, you've probably heard people say that's too good to be true. You never hear anyone say that's, you know, too terrible to be true. Maybe analyze, you know, teach kids to think through those sorts of things. And I'll just step off because I'm not a philosopher and I'm probably not a very good one if I tried.
As I have gotten older, is how important it is to always treat people with kindness, because you never know what's going on at home or what's going on behind the scenes. If someone is unnaturally grumpy or snaps at you, it may have absolutely nothing to do with you. So I think as teachers, really making sure that we look at students as people and have them look at one another as people, and not just take a behavior or a comment at face value, but to try to be empathetic and understand what may be behind the motivation behind how the other person did it. I mean, certainly every answer everyone says is perfectly valid, but certainly if we treat people with kindness, our buildings would operate much smoother every day.
Yeah, Greg Hoyt, and I appreciate the comments of the candidates that have already gone. I think my answer today is, what would be most important for a teacher to impart upon their student would be that you have value. You have worth. You are important. Students that feel that sense, I think, are going to have a clearer head so that they can think critically. I think they're going to understand that it costs $0 to be nice to somebody, to be kind, and the most negative interaction that we should have with one another would be complete neutrality. And I hope that we don't do that. But you have value.
Katie Allen, a lot of good answers. I keep crossing mine off every time somebody talks. So. I'm going to add that, you know, at this point, for something new and different, some of the things are, one thing to impart on students is self-efficacy and high expectations. I'm going to share, you know, a lot of the work I do in the nation, we work with a lot of urban schools and work with a lot of teachers. And it's a little sad when you hear them talking in terms of like, it's just the students that we got and, you know, they're not going to do that much. Let's kind of just do the minimum. And if your teacher doesn't believe in you, why would you believe in yourself and that you can really do the things that you should be doing? So just giving kids that sense of their abilities and their talents, and letting them know that we believe in them and they should have high expectations in themselves could really go a long way for a lifetime.
Andrea Engel, Conservanka. I have to ask, does anybody else have Greatest Love by Whitney Houston playing in their head? Just checking, because I think we all really truly have that heartbeat in us here. And honestly, I think the most important thing a teacher can impart is a work ethic. We just talked about skills misalignment. And so we need kids to be able to show up, do their work. When I was a kid, I was told my job was to go to school, and then I come home and do the homework. And that's what needs to happen. The job starts right away, learning how to share your crayons or whatever age-appropriate is. So I believe that the Chinese proverb, if you feed a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Well, let's teach our kids to fish responsibly by believing in themselves. Let's give them more credit. Let's let them be young, powerful people that can do things. Let's give them credit for being capable. And my favorite teachers loved me for who I was and said, go, baby, go.
I like that. Courtney Jane Hockman. For me, you know, everything that everyone says fits really well, but for me, it's an ethic of care. Teachers caring about and being excited about their curriculum, caring about their students' interests and needs, caring about other teachers and staff in the building, and modeling that care by listening and how they interact with other people. I also think that part of that is being vulnerable and sharing with students to a point. You know, I'm having a bad day. I'm sad.
my car broke down on the way to work, you know, just to create that humanity. An ethic of care really just creates empathy and strengthens relationships and just realizing that humanity.
Going first is kind of nerve-wracking, but last is even worse because I can't really get add much. But really, the answer is universal. I mean, I think we're all right on with this. I mean, being a lifelong learner is important. Being a good citizen, be respectful of others. But you know, I always reflect back on my teacher probably influenced me the most was my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Munoz, and he treated us with kindness, and he really instilled on treating others with kindness, and I think that's a key factor, and it still influences me to this day.
All right, now it's time for closing remarks. We're going to start there down there at the end with Mr. Busby. You get 2 minutes for closing remarks.
All right. Well, first I want to say thanks again to the Manhattan Chamber, to the League of Women Voters, and to everyone who came out and everyone who's listening on K-Man, and thanks to K-Man for broadcasting this. You know, it occurs to me our schools are actually fantastic, and it's great that we have this panel up here. I hope we made your decision hard, honestly, because that means that we have a lot of folks who've stuck their neck out and want to serve this community, and that's fantastic when you compare it to previous years where sometimes that wasn't always the case. I believe we do have some challenges ahead, and we've exposed a few of those going forward, and they'll be greatly magnified in the lives of our kids if we don't address those challenges. And so that's one of the things I want to do, and our first priority to that has to be their full literacy for every child in our schools, especially those kids like me that were going to struggle. Education is our single best hope for those kids. We need to get them reading and writing as early as possible. We can and should set some ambitious goals. I believe that 2/3 of our kids should go to be proficient in reading within the next 5 years with no more than 10th below the basic level. Right now, we're a lot higher than that. And we can start having, when we set those ambitious goals, we can start having those difficult conversations about what is it really going to take to achieve something that outrageous. I know you're thinking outrageous, teaching kids. Getting them to those levels, it can be. Our teaching profession is drying up. We've talked about that. It's hard to get people to want to go into the classroom. And, you know, that's just kind of a function of population and a function of kind of some of the things we've been seeing. We've got to find creative ways to recruit and retain our best and our brightest and simultaneously show those students that teaching is a noble and viable profession for their careers. And then when we tap the public resource, we need to do it in a way that doesn't threaten the stability of families or increase inequity in our community. And budget as carefully as we can, asking how will this dollar improve academic outcomes for these students. To do those things, we have to elect people of integrity, leaders willing and able to serve on a diverse team. I'm Rob Busby, an experienced leader, a team player. I'm your neighbor, I'm your friend, and I hope I can count on your vote.
Moves up here to the front. Your go.
I thought we were going this way to this way. I thought I was going to have to do the cleanup. But I'll go. All right.
You were just like living in the zen there.
Yeah, I was. I'm Kristen Brighton. I'm sorry. I've been really bad about introducing myself every time. I get so excited to talk. Again, I am a parent. I am a lifelong Manhattan resident. I'm a business owner. I've worn lots of hats. I think that gives me an advantage. I think the different people and the different experiences I've had, I like to bring them all to my role on the board. I have three primary areas of emphasis. First of all, we've got to focus on academic outcomes. In 2019, we set some very aggressive goals for improvement, and we were just getting started on those goals when the pandemic hit. And so then test scores slid even more. You know, we've got to turn some things around. We've got to get our kids in class. The chronic absenteeism has just gotten out of hand. I'm really excited to get this year's numbers and hope to God that there have been improvements over some of them from last year. But a lot of our buildings were at 30. Manhattan High School was at 48%, 49% of students who were considered technically chronically absent. So we've got to get back to those basic things, and as a board, those have to be our priorities. But again, if we don't have good quality people working in our schools, we're never going to achieve those academic outcomes. So we have to make sure we put focus on making the district a place people want to work so we can attract and retain them. And that's everything from salaries and benefits clear through making people feel welcome regardless of their personal background. And then lastly, as I think I've made clear, I'm passionate about expanding our career and technical education programs. I want us to create a work-based learning center so that we can work much more closely with the chamber and the greater business community to get a much higher percentage of our students doing work-based learning. We have about 30 students doing that per semester right now. I'd like to see us get to the point where 50% of our students graduate with a work-based learning experience on their resume. And then, as I've already said, I think there's so much more we could be doing with our partners to better prepare our students for the areas that Manhattan wants to make itself known for, and better preparing our students for careers in the health and life sciences. Thank you, and I hope that you all vote on November 7th or before.
Greg Hoyt, and I want to thank each and every one of you for your attendance, certainly K-Man for broadcasting this, and each of the candidates up here. I think school board members serve a vital role in the community. I've spent my life in this community, spent 31 years in the school district. I'm married to the community, and I want to serve in this role because I think I've got something to bring to the table. If we want the best for our kids, we've got to have the best in the buildings, whether they're administrators, teachers, office staff, custodians, food service workers, bus drivers. And the best way to support them is from the board table. Make sure that those people know that they are valued. Happy employees are going to make it easier for kids to learn. And do we have areas that we can improve in? Always. But we are blessed with a tremendous community. A tremendous community that values education. You've passed many bond issues because the school district came and asked for money. So let's be responsible with the money that you've given us, the facilities you've given us, and let's support the people that are in the buildings. Thank you.
Katie Allen, and I also want to say thank you all for coming out today and to K-Man for broadcasting so the community can hear what we all have to say. As you've heard us all, we're pretty much all on the same page with we want to improve the academics in the school, we want to support having quality teachers in our classroom, and we all have the heart to be here, and we really care about kids. One thing that does set me apart from other candidates is my experience. So I have a master's in public administration and a doctorate in education leadership and over 20 years of experience working with schools and school districts and state education agencies. I have a lot of experience working on policy issues, a lot of experience of turning policy into practice. I've worked on programs, everything from early childhood development, youth substance abuse prevention, leadership development for our schools, helping improve accountability systems at the state level. I have done a lot with second grade literacy. I've worked with many districts across our region. And so I think that kind of perspective can be really helpful at the board table because really what the board is responsible for is policy. So just having good ideas and being an advocate for great schools, it's great, but having experience can also help us actually reach some of the goals that we're all talking about. The other area that I would like to champion as a school board member that we haven't heard much of is really having a strong public education system. At the state level, there's increasing demand that we improve our schools, and we have a lot to lose if we don't really all work together to maintain the great schools that we have here and show those who actually have access to the money that we're doing great things, we're making sure we're improving, and we make sure that our kids are actually meeting the standards and outcomes that are expected at that state level. Thank you.
Andrea Engelken-Cervenka, and I thank you all for being here and whoever is also listening. I represent the everyday person here in Manhattan. While my master's work might be in English, while I might have worked for the Department of Chemical Engineer editing and things, the bottom line is the public pays and deserves to know what's going on, and they deserve to have kids be able to read and write and do math. We are all feeling the crunch, and we cannot just keep asking for money and voting for pie-high dreams without making sure the basics are taken care of. So I'm the watchtower to make sure that the cart doesn't get put in front of the horse. We have to, and also legally, the state is requiring that we improve our outcomes for students, and we do have standardized tests. And in the meantime, I would like to make sure that the schools stay functioning as they should while we support a robust, diverse community that grows around those schools and are also overlap a bit, but we need to get to work in our schools, and then we can play outside of them. I hope you'll vote for me. Thank you.
Courtney Jane Hockman, I really appreciate everyone that came out, everyone that's listening. Voting is a privilege and a right and a civic duty, so thank you for helping yourself and others become more informed. I want what's best for our students. I want them to feel supported and welcome in our buildings because, and our staff and our faculty, because if you don't feel good about being there, you can't get the job done. We can't improve academics if we are feeling like we're in a hostile place. Yes, we have work to do with reading and math, but I also think that we can look to other states and see what they're doing about overhauls of metrics, because standardized testing has not changed in a long time. It's, you know, we don't have to get rid of it completely, but how can we do it so that we're teaching best for our learners and measuring how they, what they know by how they learn the best way? And one of the ways that I've come to learn a lot about that is because of my oldest son being in special education. Last year, it was very meaningful. I'm trying to stay on topic. But he got a seventh grade award along with his class because he met what his goals on his IEP. And so just because he wasn't doing the exact same things, he met his goals. And so he deserved to be there just as much as everyone else, and he was included in that. So finding meaningful ways to recognize what our students are doing, finding ways to teach to them, letting teachers be creative with the state requirements for their field and for their grade level. I'm a mom. I'm a parent. That's the most important reason why I'm here. But because of that, I have friends who are parents and have children in this district. So it doesn't just end with trying to do better for my kids. It has to do with trying to do better for all the kids in our community.
Kurt Herman. Thank you, everybody, for coming, and appreciate the attendance tonight. And I thank all the candidates, too. I think we all have the same goal at heart, as what's best for kids and what's best for our schools. So I'm really proud of everybody for stepping up. Education stands as a cornerstone of society, and I think all children deserve access to a world-class education, and I think we provide that here. I think some of our challenges are we're still kind of recovering from COVID, an educational process, and addressing the diverse needs of students, security of our schools for our staff and our students, addressing mental health issues, I'm running for the school board, I guess, to ensure that we not only survive but flourish in the face of all these challenges. I bring a unique skill set, I guess, to the board. You know, I have 16 years of experience as a board member. It gives me institutional knowledge. I've also been on the Kansas Association of School Boards Board of Directors for 8 years, I represent 43 school districts at the state level. That really gives me not only institutional but statewide knowledge, and it keeps me really in tune with the legislature and the process going on there, and I got a pretty good relationship with a lot of our legislators as well at that. So if elected, I'll work tirelessly to support our staff. You know, and I say it a lot, we're not successful in the district because of the school board. It's our staff that makes a difference. Another one of my mantras is nobody can name the last five Academy Award winners, but someone can always name a teacher that made a difference in their lives.
Frank Beer, I want to say thank you to all of you and also everybody up at this table, and the folks who put this on and the folks at KMAN. All of you, I appreciate a bunch. I want to go back to my opening statement. My kids got a great education in Manhattan. I'm passionate about kids doing so. And I entered this race with three and identified three items that are important to me. First one is parents first. Parents first, I understand kids are most important. but keeping parents first, keeping them involved in their kids' education, and keeping the rest of the community involved is so important. Making sure that parents know everything that's going on with their kids and are fully informed on that is so important. Number two, wise budgets. We just experienced a very large increase in spending. I think there needed to be more discussion on that. I think the taxpayers deserve more discussion on that. I have told the folks in administration, if I'm elected to the board, expect meetings might last 20 or 30 minutes longer, at least at times, because I'm going to ask questions. I won't get them answered in advance. I will actually ask them because you, the taxpayer, deserve that. And the last thing is proper mission. We need to stay focused. We talked about the need for improving. We had a challenge with COVID. It's very important that we get back on proper mission. In the old days, you said reading, writing, and arithmetic. I get it's more than that. One quick proposal, and I'm holding up for the folks in Radio Land my cell phone. I propose that these be shelved at the beginning of the day and maybe there at lunch and then picked up. Yes, the kids will all go through agony for a month, but they'll get over it, and they'll be better for it. So I hope that you'll consider voting for me. And, again, thank you to everyone, and I appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you, candidates. Before we give the candidates their applause and farewell, I want to make a couple announcements about some important Election Day stuff. First of all, as I hope you all know, Election Day is Tuesday, November the 7th. Don't forget to vote. The last day to register to vote is October the 17th at noon. October the 17th at noon. Then early voting starts the next day. In-person mail-in advance voting begins at Riley County on October the 18th. And the last day to advance vote, get this, is the day before in-person voting, which is November the 6th. Also at noon. And the last day to apply for a mail-in ballot is the 31st. Now let's give our thanks for everybody's coming. Yeah. We can all take a deep breath and go home for dinner.
And that's going to conclude the second candidate forum here on News Radio KMAN. We just heard from the eight of the 10 candidates here for the USD 383 school board, a couple of them that did not participate, and there's some good reason for that. Audrey Swartz, she's an employee here of the Manhattan Public Library, and it was a conflict of interest, so she decided not to participate in that today. The other one was Nolan Foth, the other candidate who was not here today, but we did hear from Katie Allen, Frank Beer, Kristen Brighton, Robert Busby, Andrea Engelken-Cervenka, Kurt Herman, Courtney Hockman, and Greg Hoyt here as this forum just concluded. Of course, we had the City Commission candidate forum earlier today with seven participants in that one, excuse me. We heard from Susan Adamczyk, Rosemary Laux, Mark Hattasall, John Mata, Karen McCullough, Peter Opelt, and Rafael Rodriguez Jr. in that one. So what we're going to do is we'll have this archived on our website at newsradiokman.com for folks to go back and listen to at their convenience, and we will continue to produce some stories from these. There's some good topics discussed here today in the school board candidate forum. If you missed any of it, some of the questions that were asked centered around how relationships can be improved between and among administrators, teachers, and students, as well as the community. Kind of the understanding of the community's interest to change the mascot, of course, that came up. And there was also questions on budgeting and a position on alternative credentialing. That was a subject that was discussed quite at length there. And also the needs of making sure that people from diverse backgrounds are supported. So got into some great discussion here. The forum lasted about just under 2 hours, so I got it in here and want to say thanks again to the League of Women Voters of Manhattan Riley County for putting this on. The co-sponsors, of course, including the American Association of University Women, local chapter here, and the Manhattan Area Chamber of Commerce. And so thanks to them. We'll also say a quick shout-out to the Manhattan Public Library for hosting this event here today. In their auditorium, and their tech folks here, superb, helping us get making sure that we were accommodated so we could broadcast this and bring it to you live, commercial-free. And so we are so thankful for their help today to get that taken care of and make sure we didn't have any hiccups here this morning. I want to also give a shout-out to our studio engineer, Bernie Fancella, making sure things are going out over the airwaves so you can hear this. This is a public service we like to do each year ahead of these elections. We usually partner with the League of Women Voters, and it's been a long-standing relationship. It predates my time here. I've only been here for 5 years. So this has been a nice relationship that we've had with the League of Women Voters, and just so happy that we could do this just because, you know, we got elections, and it's important that you're informed and you know kind of where people stand on these issues. So with that said, we're going to end our live broadcast here. We thank you for listening and hope you took some value out of this these two great candidate forums here today. And we're going to send it back to our regular programming here on News Radio KMAN. Have a great weekend. I'm Brandon Peoples.